most of us are still in the younger years of our growth and development and learning, we probably haven't yet totally experienced this kind of a phenomenon. But, I don't know if I should call myself older yet. We're still fighting for the youth a little bit, but to have the opportunity to be able to hear from one of our own rebbeim once again is really a tremendous opportunity. I wouldn't even say it brings back old memories, but things that are very much are still alive and well in the daily engagement in Talmud Torah that takes place here in the Beis Medrash on a regular basis. Something to express a karas hatov to Rosenzweig, not just for coming today and not just for the talk that we're about to hear, which we'll introduce momentarily, but obviously the karas hatov of a Talmud to a Rebbe is much greater than a mere thank you and an introduction. It really can't be verbalized. Certainly I can't, at least. I'm sure Rebbe can verbalize things much better than I can, but can't be expressed adequately. But perhaps that I think it's certainly fair to say that the derech and learning that many of the talmidim have picked up here in the yeshiva through the shiurim on a daily basis, many of the thoughts, many of the ideas, techniques, yesodos that have come out, and perhaps even many of the actual content of some of the sugyas that we've learned, really is an ongoing expression of a karas hatov to someone who had given me a tremendous yesod in my own growth and learning many years back. This morning we have the opportunity, as we explained somewhat earlier, to have two different chances to learn from Rav Rosenzweig. Right now here, the Beis Medrash, Klali, for everybody, we're going to be having a really very, I think, should prove to be a special opportunity, as we're approaching we're in the week right now of the story of Kabbalah Satorah, Matan Torah. We'll have a chance right now to hear a discussion about the concepts of Talmud Torah, of Derech HaLimud, how to be learning, perhaps even some examples of methodology of Lamdus and what the Brisker Derech is all about, explained in a clear kind of a way, which really should be a great chance for all of us to take the things we're going to hear and really just start to plug them back immediately into the learning that will be going on throughout the day and throughout the upcoming weeks and months that we're going to be continuing on in learning. At 12 o'clock, there'll be a shiur in the general sugya makos for some of the shiur. Not everyone will be coming, but speak to your rebbeim, I'll direct who should be there or not, and that'll be taking place. We at a yet to be discovered location, but we'll tell you exactly where to go before 12 o'clock once we get the placement worked out. But there was a tiru kavod the Torah to Mori Virabi to Rav Rosenzweig.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've had the opportunity in the past, to do the yeshiva, and it's always special for me to be in a makom Torah where my own talmidim are rebbeim, and I've been saying this, most of the places where I go, because whatever, I guess at this point I really do have talmidim who are ramen in many of these yeshivot, but it's true in each case. It's really an extraordinary source of nachas, and for me, it really represents kind of a living experience of Mesorah. I feel myself very much as having been molded by my own rebbeim, and then to see my talmidim in leadership positions and doing the wonderful work of Harbatas HaTorah. And then, I'm here also on behalf of, mostly on behalf of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, the opportunity of, sharing Talmidim with my Talmidim is a special nofach, and I've had that opportunity already for many, many years, where I, get Talmidim from the Yeshivot here, where Talmidim already, sometimes they know what I'm going to say in advance, it's a little bit dangerous. But only in a really exceptionally positive way. So I want to thank you again, Poskim B'Chvod Achsanya, for inviting me. I'm always happy to be here and to share some thoughts in this case, as well as a more traditional shiur. So as Rav Gordon mentioned, this week's parsha is Parshas Yisro. Parshas Yisro is really a focal point. Not only going forward, Yaseres HaDibros, Maimed Har Sinai, the experience of Maimed Har Sinai, but really was the anticipated moment for which the world was created, according to Chazal. In the first words of the Torah, Bereshis Bara Elokim Eis HaShamayim Ves HaAretz, Bishvil HaTorah Shenikra Reishis. And then, of course, you know, when we get to the first expression of Kedusha, Shabbos, it's, you know, we speak about Yom HaShishi. HaShishi, Chazal tell us, is a reference also to the sixth day of Sivan, the day of Nesinas HaTorah. And the Gemara says in Shabbos, you know, that if not for that day, and if not for Klal Yisrael's acceptance of the Torah, that, you know, the world would have been turned back to a state of chaos, of tohu vavohu. All these and many, many, many more expressions of Chazal, you know, underscore the accepted principle, which is that the Torah, Limud HaTorah, we'll discuss what that means, immersion in the concepts of Torah, really is the raison d'etre, it's the goal, the purpose of creation itself. When we ask, you know, the question that, you know, everybody asks, all human being asks, and that is, what is the purpose of creation? What is the purpose of human existence? The halachic answer, the kedusha answer to that question, is bereshis bishvil haTorah shenikra reishis. In order to attach ourselves to Dvar Hashem, that's what a meaningful life for us is all about. That was not just the purpose of our meaningful life, but the purpose of creation itself. And therefore, Maimon Har Sinai has really two components, but those two components really integrate, you know, into one. On the one hand, there is the tochen of Torah that was given at Maimon Har Sinai, and, you know, how that expressed itself in this week's Parsha, you know, beginning with the Aseres HaDibros, which the Rav Sajigon and the Ramban are of the opinion also embody the rest of the Taryag Mitzvos. The experience of receiving that is one aspect, and then of course the experience of just being present at the moment of Maimon Har Sinai is the second component. And as we know, the Ramban, in his Minyan HaMitzvos and Sefer HaMitzvos, and again in his Perush Al HaTorah, counts separately the Zachar, if you will, of Maimon Har Sinai. Ilu Kervanu Lefnei Har Sinai V'Lanasa Lanu Es HaTorah Dayenu. Probably expresses that idea, namely that just being there when his galus, when the Gilui Shechina of HaKadosh Baruch Hu by means of Matan Torah, Nesinas HaTorah, took place, that in itself was enough. But it went further, Baruch Hashem, and you know, Shavuach Arbana Mikalo Amim V'Nasam Lanu Es Torah So V'Chai Olam Nata B'Sochenu. So the focal point is that we should always see in Limud HaTorah our connection to and our immersion in the content of Torah a way of reigniting and reenacting the experience of Maimon Har Sinai. And that's why many of the dinim of Limud HaTorah, you know, connect back to that. The Isur of Balkari in Limud HaTorah, according to Gemara and Brachos, is based really on, again, the level of Eima and Pachad, you know, which existed at that magical moment, the moment for which the world was created, the moment of Gilui Shechina. The moment of Gilui Shechina in the Nesinas HaTorah was also the moment which established that, you know, Torah was to be vast and comprehensive, that again, it was to be the main focus of Klal Yisrael. We'll get back to that in a minute. Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, a mitzvah tmidis, a mitzvah that breaks other rules, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. But it also established that there would be not only comprehensive, but kind of a wide range, and also a not only a Nesinas HaTorah, but a Kabbalas HaTorah. We're all familiar with the Gemara in Masechet Erevin, which speaks about the principle of Elu Ve'elu Divar Elokim Chayim. The Gemara there records that there was a raging, you know, machlokas between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, and ultimately, you know, the Bas Kol decided that Elu ve'elu divar Elokim chayim v'halacha kebeis Hillel. We're not going to discuss the details of that and the implications of it fully, but we know that there is a concept that there are multiple truths within the proper methodology of applying the Torah, right? There's a range of views. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai are all chafta shel Torah. Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon are all chafta shel Torah. Abaye and Rava all Chafetz Shel Torah. The Rambam, you know, and Rabbeinu Tam, even when they argue, it's all Chafetz Shel Torah. According to the Marshal, in his famous Hakdama to the Yom Shel Shlomo in Bava Kamma, the source of that flexible range, again, within an accepted methodology, it's a narrow range, but an important range. And the source for that was Kabbalah Satorah at Maimon Har Sinai. Klal Yisrael, 600,000 at least men who were present at the moment of Gilui Shechina. And according to Yom Shel Shlomo, in a very, can't exaggerate this, in a very subtle way, but as we'll discuss, when it comes to Derech HaLimud and when it comes to, the nuances of Torah, subtleties, tend to have a great impact, what I call a ripple effect. So according to Yom Shel Shlomo, every one of the 600,000, who was present at Maimon Har Sinai didn't hear the facts differently. That would be peculiar and that would be problematic. But they understood or they received the Torah, right, in a slightly different fashion. And that became the source, according to the Marshal, for the idea of Elu Velu Divrei Elokim Chayim, or Shivim Panim LaTorah, as it should be really Shishim Ribo Panim LaTorah. Maybe it's interesting that it isn't. But the idea that there can be a range of understandings of the Torah within an accepted mahalach of what the rules are, what the concepts, with there being red lines, that demarcate the outside parameters of that. That is something which is very much a perspective that is embraced by the world of Torah and Halacha. And for that reason, we can say things like, Ein Beis HaMedrash Belo Chiddush. Chiddush is a very admired category, even though we're talking about, Torah Shebichtav, which is a fixed text, and we're talking about Torah Shebaal Peh, which is supposed to be transmitted from generation to generation to generation, scrupulously, rigorously, right, carefully, and so on. That was entrusted to the Chachmei HaMesorah. And still we can speak about Chidushim and different Drachim, and again, a range of Eilu Veilu Divrei Elokim Chayim in the context of even very combative, ferocious machloksim. Again, the machlokas Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, which is characterized by the Gemara as Eilu Veilu Divrei Elokim Chayim, wasn't fully, maybe on the Beis Hillel side it was, but on the Beis Shammai side it certainly got ferocious. It was really ferocious on both sides. The Gemara says that we paskin like Beis Hillel because they were more gentlemanly about it. When they used to acknowledge the machlokas, they used to quote the position of Beis Shammai, before Beis Hillel. I've explained in the past, and I found subsequently that the Maral says something very, very similar. That, what the Gemara means is not that, the midos tovos, the etiquette, being polite, and being maktim, divrei chavercha l'dvarecha, that earned them the Musar credits, which gave them the halachic victory. I think that, again, would be very disturbing. Good manners, good etiquette, midos tovos, a posture of Musar, all these things are very, very, very important. But there's too much at stake in, serious halachic debate, for that to be the deciding factor. So clearly that's not what Chazal had in mind. But what they did have in mind was that Beis Hillel had an even greater, let's say, appreciation or their application of the idea of Eilu Veilu Divrei Elokim Chayim, of recognizing and therefore examining, reflecting upon, the range of views that are acceptable and, as part of the determination of Mishpat Echad Yelachem to come to a single conclusion, they struggled with it more than Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai had a more decisive posture. Shammai himself was that kind of more of a decisive personality. And what Chazal is telling us is that because their conclusion was a result, maybe, of giving benefit of the doubt to the other position, in a more flexible way, so their conviction, their final determination and conclusion was a stronger conclusion because of it. In other words, the etiquette part, the midos tovos part, contributed substantively to their ultimate conclusion. But in the end of the day, this is what happened in Maimon Har Sinai, is that the Torah was given, that at that point, Klal Yisrael's destiny was linked to immersing themselves in that material, and through it, the experience of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and at that same time, different, you know, a range, a limited range, both in terms of the content and presumably also in terms of the derech of Limud HaTorah was conveyed as well, and that became part of the ethos, part of the, you know, hashkafa of halacha, if you will, and part of the methodology of halacha, and that is to pursue the different components, the different elements of Torah, hafochba, hafochba, dekulaba, its tremendous range, and the beauty and the grandeur of that range. And that's what we have been doing ever since. Moshe Kibal Torah Misinai, Mesorah LeYoshua, Yoshua LeZkenim. The Mefarshim on the Mishnayos and Avos note, for example, that the verbs, you know, are sometimes missing or sometimes not the same. Sometimes it's Masar, sometimes it's Masar Kibel, sometimes it's just Kibel. And they too suggest that these are references to, you know, breakthroughs in methodology, my language, but this is what they're basically saying. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu's method and Yoshua and Zakenim, sometimes they were just, you know, in the same mode, you know, a brisker, the son of another brisker, and sometimes there were, you know, nuanced changes in the methodology. It's important to identify, to try to identify that range and those changes. But all of that is part of the history of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's part of the legacy and the repository of Torah itself. The Netziv, in his Hagdama to his Perush on the Sheiltos, the Kidmas HaEmek, you know, discusses, you know, how different eras in the history of Limud HaTorah, you know, emphasize different things: Torah Shebetzav era, Torah Shebaal Peh era, a Pilpul era, a Pshat era. And he makes reference to this a lot, that it was a very, very consistent writer. He wrote a lot, and he was very consistent. He was very creative. He was always adding things, but he refers back a lot to the things that he wrote. You look, you know, if you read regularly the HaMikdavar, you'll see this is a leitmotif in the Netziv's writing. You know, the menorah represents this kind of perspective on Limud HaTorah, and the Shulchan represents that kind of perspective, etc. All of these, and we could just, you know, speak, you know, for many, many hours about the different reflections of this, you know, in the Medrash and in the Gemara and in the Rishonim and in the Achronim. This is like a basic, very basic idea that, you know, Torah was given at Sinai. It was given, you know, by the Ribbono Shel Olam, who, of course, you know, embodies Yichud Hashem. It came from a single source. It was given, you know, by means partially of Moshe Rabbeinu, Roa Echad Nitnu. Gemara speaks about, you know, how that could be, the Gemara in Chagiga. How could it be that, you know, Halalu Matirim and Halalu Osrim, you know, when it all came, Miroa Echad from Moshe Rabbeinu. But that's the secret, that's the unique and singular aspect of Torah, that it is both Mesorah and Chiddush. There's a range, and there's also a methodology of Mishpat Echad Yelachem. And part of the grand history of Talmud Torah is, you know, is seeing all these strata. You can't be narrow in your learning. You have to know, you know, that it includes Torah Shebetzav and Torah Shebaal Peh, and the different you know, emphases in Torah Shebaal Peh, Lidore Doros, you know, from the very beginning of this process. The truth is that this is reflected in Birchas HaTorah as well, right? The Gemara says in Brachos that Kishem Hashem, commenting on the pasuk in the end of Devarim, Kishem Hashem Ekra Habu Godel Elokeinu, that is the makor for Birchas HaTorah. And the Ramban, famously in Sefer Mitzvos, suggests that the Rambam should have counted Birchas HaTorah in the minyan of Taryag, and he left it out, and he's upset about it. And he says, after all, it's pasuk in Devarim, it's a Gemara in Brachos. Kishem Hashem Ekrohavu Godel Elokeinu. Birchas HaTorah is a mitzvah d'orais. Again, there's a debate among the Achronim whether the Rambam, who omits it, thinks that Birchas HaTorah is drabana. That's certainly the majority view. Or he might even agree with the Ramban, but he doesn't think it belongs separately in Minyan HaMitzvahs. The point is that the Ramban's position particularly aligns well with the comment that he makes in the beginning of Bereishis, in his Hakdama to his Perush al HaTorah. There the Ramban says that Kol HaTorah Kula is Shemosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Again, it's a semi or maybe a mostly mystical comment, probably, but I believe that it's also a hardcore halakhic comment. And I think it links up with the Ramban's decision to count and say for mitzvos, Kishem Hashem Ekra Havu Godel Alokeinu, not only he assumes it's not an asmachta, but it's a din doraisa, there are almost no brachos that are doraisa, aside from Birkas HaMazon. There's some question about Birkas HaMotzi and other things, but pretty much most brachos in Rabbanan, the idea that Birkas HaTorah is doraisa is remarkable. But what's more remarkable is the makar that the Gemara provides. Kishem Hashem Ekra Havu Godel Alokeinu, what is Shem Hashem Ekra have to do with Liman HaTorah? But the answer is, you know, and I think the Ramban, as I say, I don't know which came first or if they both came together, but I think it's just a no-brainer, very compelling that these two formulations are two sides of the same coin, that we look at Limud HaTorah as Kishem Hashem Ekra. It's the way that we connect to the Rabbono Shel Olam, that's why it's Bishvil HaTorah Shenikra Reishis, and Kol HaTorah Kula Shemosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Put aside Kabbalah and mysticism, you know, forget about all that for the moment, right? It's really an apt, a very ambitious, but an apt description, which has enormous implications for the way that we learn, for our derech halimud, etc. And that is that the concepts of Torah and attaching ourselves to what the Rambam sometimes calls the achdut hamaskil v'hamuskal. How can we connect to the Rabbono Shel Olam? He's omniscient, he's omnipotent, he's transcendent. We're puny, mortal, right? You know, pathetic, you know, human beings. The answer is that we need to connect with him, otherwise our life really has no purpose. It should be philosophically impossible. And the answer is that Ratzach Kodesh Baruch Hu Lezakos is Yisrael. That was the Chiddush of Gilui Shechina at Maimed Har Sinai, and that was that it established a methodology of connecting with him, and it was Kishem Hashem Ekra Havu Godel Alokeinu. A name is an access point in a relationship, and what we're being told is that if you want to do the impossible, which is also indispensable, namely connect with the Rabbono Shel Olam, it's through Kishem Hashem Ekra. You can call his name in some respects, you know, by attaching yourself to Dvar Hashem, to what he gave us. And in our case, what that means is, that's why Birchas HaTorah is Ramban, not a Birchas HaMitzvah, clearly as he describes it, it's a Birchas Shevach V'Hoda, on the Cheftza Shel Torah, to use the language of Reb Chaim, it's a Bracha on Cheftza Shel Torah, it's a recognition of the role that Torah plays, the role that Torah plays as the means for, the mechanism for us connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we do that, therefore, the Birchas HaTorah tells us that Talmud Torah is the method of doing that. And therefore it becomes very critical, on the one hand, to appreciate, you know, the range of our Mesorah, and this idea of Shivim Panim, or Elu V'Elu, this idea that, you know, Moshe Kibel, and sometimes there's Kibel, and sometimes there's Masar, namely that there are different emphases. But it's important to think very seriously about what our goals are and what the nature of, you know, Limud HaTorah, you know, is really all about. The truth is, our different genre in Torah, the Gemara Brachos Nafei Amud Aleph, commenting on the pasuk, not in this week's parsha, coming parsha, but the one after that in Mishpatim, Bo'et l'chos esluchos ha'eben haTorah v'mitzvos asher kasavti l'dorosam, right? So understands that each of those represents a certain genre in Torah. And Torah Shebichsav, and Torah Shebaal Peh, and the Aseres HaDibros, and the Neviim, and Ksuvim, Mishnah, Gemara. These are all different types of Torah texts, each of which requires an approach, you know, a way of immersing ourselves in them. So we have a range of different genres, and we also have different methods or different possible methods of how we connect, you know, to each and every genre. And what we have to be thinking about is what the nature of each of these genres is and what our approach should be. certainly the one that we want to accentuate today, and this is what we do in our schedule, in our kind of life's commitment, is the Havayos Dabayeva Rava. It's the Talmud part, the part of the Shakavataria, Torah Shebal Peh. And the reason that that became the centerpiece of the focus of Limud HaTorah is because it's there that the more comprehensive picture of the concepts of the constitutional content or substance of values in Torah life are really expressed. The Shaklavatarya of the Gemara that we immerse ourselves with throughout much of the day is the centerpiece of our learning because it really combines the sources, the analysis. It is the source for really the token of halacha in the Kadosh Baruch Hu Balamo El Dalad Amos Shel Halacha. But the reason for that is that essentially the goal in the end of the day is Kishem Hashem Ekra Havagod Elokim. We attach ourselves to the Ribbono Shel Olam, as we said, through attaching ourselves to Dvar Hashem. And what that really means is that we want to transform ourselves, into, we'll use the Rav's formulation, Ishe Halacha. Our goal is really to live a life where we're not just, executing, Ratzon Kodesh Baruch Hu Lezakos Es Yisrael Lefikach Hivelem Torah Mitzvos. So we're executing God's Ratzon Hashem so we can build up credit, for the next phase. Lihonos Beziv Ashkina, to, get through the Traklin, and get to the ultimate scar of Olam Haba. We want to get the scar of Olam Haba, right? But we also want to capitalize on the spiritual opportunities of this world to transform ourselves into Anshe Kodesh Tiyun Li, Mablechas Kohanim Begoy Kadosh. And the way that we do that, Yofa Sha'achas B'Olam Hazeh, Yoser Mikol Yimos Olam Haba, is by immersing ourselves in Dvar Hashem in a way that really redefines who we are and allows us to cultivate the values of a certain lifestyle, a certain life orientation, in a way that is transformative and allows us to touch transcendence. And the way that we learn, the assumptions that we make about the nature of the, which I'm going to get to in just a second, of the material in front of us and what we try to do with it, should be connected to that goal. The goal of becoming, each and every one of us, an Ish HaLacha, an Oved Hashem, right, who not only does the right thing, but something that really transforms one's persona. When the Rambam, in Hilchos Tshuva, talks about Tshuva, he talks about, Mishanes Shemo, right, the Omer Eini Osa Isha Osa Osa Mamasim, the idea of adopting or assuming a persona of an Oved Hashem is really a critical concept in Torah. So when we look at the Havayos Dabayeva Rava, which is the focus of that, because that's the most ambitious, that's where all of the halachic world is unfolded in front of us, and every Shaklavataria and Machlokes and Havamina in a certain way is exploring, right, each one of the Taryag Mitzvot and their, assumptions and their values. So we have to ask ourselves two questions. One is, what is the nature of all of this material in front of us, the material of Hayis Davayv Rava, the Shas? And more importantly, what is the mode of thinking, that we should be focusing upon? What is it that we want to extract? What is it we want to gain from our Leva? And as I said, there's a whole history of that. If Kal Yisrael, standing in Maimon Har Sinai, were exposed to Elo Velo Divar Lekim Chayim, obviously that was in Tochen and also in methodology. And if you look at the different strata, I mentioned the Netziv and others who pointed out, and the language in the beginning of Abos, but it seems clear that different Tanaim had different, points of emphasis or certain patterns, consistent patterns, right, in the emphasis of Tanaim and Amaraim. School, certainly, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. But even more importantly, when you get to the, since we don't have so much time and we want to move this along historically, when you get to the post-Talmudic literature, it's clear that there were different kinds of contributions and different emphases in Derech HaLiba. So, for example, skip the Gonim because that's a little more complicated for the moment. But the what's sometimes known as a pre-Rashi Ashkenaz literature of the 11th century, and Rashi himself, the focus is very much on the Shakhna Vatari, the Gemara itself. You have to start by understanding the material in a rigorous analytical way. And that starts with the local sugya, and especially with the, with each line and each word, in front of you. So if you look at, the Perush Rabbeinu Gershom, which wasn't written by Rabbeinu Gershom, but by Chachmei Ashkenaz, early Chachmei Ashkenaz, the school of maybe of Rabbeinu Gershom, and other parallels that we have, and down to Rashi, just that Rashi kind of, Rashi's contribution was so enormous that it basically eclipsed, all of the things that had preceded it. Rashi's comprehensiveness in writing Perush practically on all of Shas, and again, in his special skill, right, in terms of his brevity and his, impeccable use of the right word, his impeccable ability, again, to combine, in his Perush HaTorah, certainly, Pshat and Chazal, but also in the Gemara. So in a certain respect, Rashi eclipsed all of the his contemporaries and the people before him, but it was already a whole trend. The focus initially is on making the sugya that is on the page in front of you accessible. Aramaic is hard, right? It's hard. There are no periods at the end of the sentence, no commas. Some of the language is a bit difficult. So there was a whole several generations which were simply dedicated to deciphering the text and analyzing the local, we'll call it the parochial sugya. And that was a Derech HaLimud. The Balei Tosis, right, who were obviously, some of whom were prominently related to Rashi, his grandchildren, Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam, and the Talmidim of Rabbeinu Tam, the whole school of Balei Tosis, constitute a major departure, from Rashi, his contemporaries, and pre-Rashi, and the Gonim, but again, we'll leave the Gonim out for now because we don't have time to examine some of that. Before it, the Balei Tosis, may just seem like an additional perush, but again, this is emblematic of the idea of chidush and hemshech and chidush. The Balei Tosis seem like they're just responding to Rashi's. Rashi took positions in his interpretation, and also in the Shitos and the Gemara, and then the Balei Tosis came along, and they in any base medrash, they argued, they accepted, they expanded, they argued vociferously, etc. But of course, if we have a bit of sensitivity, and sometimes the things that are in front of us are most difficult to see, as the Ramchal noted in Zakdama to Mesilas Yesharim, Balei Tosis's perspective on Shas and their methodology, their initial methodology, I'll explain what I mean in a second, in approaching the Gemara and the Shaka Vitaria, constitutes a revolutionary change, we'll call it an revolutionary change in Limud HaTorah. The assumption of the Balei Tosis, unspoken, things that are unspoken but that are omnipresent, are much stronger convictions. This is true for anybody who does something, it's kind of evident in everything they do. They don't need to articulate it. The Balei Tosis never wrote, what I'm about to say, but it's implicit in anybody who reads Tosis. And if you didn't notice it now, till now, then you'll notice it as soon as the words come out. The Balei Tosis's perspective was not parochial to the sugya; it was global to Shas. Again, some of these insights come from different people. Some of them from my mentor, at least in matters of Derech HaLimud, in some respects, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. But the Balei Tosis assumed that all of Shas was basically one sugya. that, you know, sounds more revolutionary than probably it is. In other words, they didn't ignore the local sugya in front of them, but Rashi had already, you know, determined, you know, pretty much in an authoritative way, all things being equal, you could argue with this or that, but, you know, Rashi made, you know, each individual sugya basically accessible to, you know, the Kahala Lomdim of Klal Yisrael. And he did such a magnificent job that, you know, there wasn't much left to do. The next shlav in the evolution of Libud HaTorah was to scrutinize his conclusions and interpretations, but because he made each sugya in Shas accessible, so you could now look at the totality of the evidence, the global evidence, and in addition to the local perush on the sugya, this of course ended up affecting how you read the local perush in the sugya, as I'll explain in a moment. Right, the next task was to try to figure out, you know, how does the sugya in Bava Kamma fit with the Gemara in Sanhedrin? You know, or the sugya in Yevamos, you know, doesn't that seem to contradict the one in Ksuvas? Now, it should be noted that, again, like all evolutions, they don't come in one fell swoop. If they did, it would be problematic, especially in something like Libud HaTorah, because, you know, Kula Miroa Echad Nitnu, and it all comes from one source, the Ribbono Shel Olam and Moshe Rabbeinu, and so on. And we don't look to be machadesh, chidushim that are unself-conscious, but that flow from the Shakla Vitaria and further Shakla Vitarias, and just the, you know, the continuity of the process. They're the ones that are the most natural and the most authentic. So it should be noted that there's never, in Derech HaLimud, there's never an absolute break. Because people who pioneer a derech don't do so intentionally. They're not out to make a reputation. And again, you know, we live in a world today, not just today, it's just worse today, where self-aggrandizement, you know, people looking, you know, for a niche. In some things it's also fine, but, you know, the you know, people trying to make a name for themselves, a kardam lach barbo, is just like the norm. You know, people blog and they, I don't want to start, you know, blogging about blogging, but you get the idea. But we're talking about, you know, Chach Mehamasora, Shebechol Dor Vador, you know, and the reverence that they had to what they received from their Rebbeim, from, you know, Kibbalah Masa. And yet they were creative people, and yet the process as it reached, you know, because of the advances, you know, of Rashi, it was time for the next step to take place. So, of course, you don't get a radical and an absolute break, not in either direction. The Bali Tosis made, you know, thousands of comments on the local sugya. And of course, they started with an analysis of the local sugya. And Rashi, numerous times, you know, makes comments implicit, and in some cases even vim tomar v'yesh lomar, or practically vim tomar v'yesh lomar, that are more in the mode of what we identify and associate with the Bali Tosas. Right? Identify Rashi in Brachos when he talks about chinuch, and Rashi in Brachos when he talks about Lasasur. In any Masechta, we could identify Rashis where you have an actual or the equivalent of Vim Tomar V'yesh Lomar, where Rashi is troubled by the conflicting evidence of another sugya, and where he's giving, I'll explain in a minute, the kind of answers that Bali Tosas typically would give. So Rashi, you know, already anticipated, not anticipated, it's, even if your focus is on making accessible the sugya, the parochial sugya, of course, if you know the other sugyas, then you're going to have to relate somewhat, right, to the other issues. But the Bali Tosas, who also weigh in on their parshanut in sugyas, basically their chiddush was to, you know, undertake this enterprise of globalizing, right, the topics. So they were just scrutinizing, we have the sugya in front of us, we have another sugya, what do we do? And they developed, therefore, they took all of the, every topic and made it into a Shas topic. Their methodology in resolving stiros was sometimes to argue that there's a machlokas sugya. In other cases, to give hechetimtzi answers based on the evidence to reconcile. But they also, again, they didn't pioneer this. We have this, I'll explain in a moment. In the Gemara, you have conceptual formulations. There are some Gemaras that read like Reb Chaim's. Okay. Again, actually, I can demonstrate this, but not at the time. Gemara's in Krisus and in Shabbos, and in every Masechta, there are a few lines which sound like chakiras and you know, very lamdashe formulations in the Gemara. that way of thinking, the idea that, you know, we're not just trying to understand the text and to reconcile any kind of contradiction, and to reconcile it by, you know, assuming that there are contingencies, that there are inconsistencies that explain it, or that there's a machlokas hasugya, or, you know, something of a more external way, but that sometimes, oh, a contradiction reveals that we need to go back and reassess the concept, the idea, and to understand it in a much more punctilious way. What looks like concept A, right, really, subtly, is either A or B. Right? In other words, you know, when the Gemara speaks about karka and betaltalin, you know, and distinguishes between them, you know, once you start looking at the evidence, so sometimes it's karka and betaltalin, and other times it's really mechubar and talush. Right? Most mechubar is karka and most talush is metaltalin, but really these are two different ideas and two different concepts. Right? That's what I mean about evidence forcing you to reassess concept. We have this already in the Gemara. We have this somewhat in Rashi. And it explodes in Rabbeinu Tam and the Baalei Tosfos, meaning the idea of being miyashev on the basis of conflicting evidence by going back and assessing the concepts in a more subtle and nuanced way. And this, of course, produces a new revolution, a new wrinkle in the next stage of Torah Shabbat. And once you have the, you know, the Baalei Tosfos scrutinizing all of Shas and redefining certain concepts, the concept of Shibudim, which the Gemara speaks about, you know, Rabbeinu Tam, you know, revealed that really there are two aspects of Shibud that interrelate, and you need to understand the connection between them. One thing is called Shibud Aguf, and the other is called Shibud Nechasim. There's a Shibud that results from a personal state of indebtedness, and there's also, you know, all of my ownery, all of my property, everything that I own, which is, you know, connected to the debts that I incur. What is the relationship, once you've identified these two pieces, between them? That redefines the whole way that we look at Shibudim, Sugis above Basra and above Metzia and Ksubis, and so on and so forth. Meaning the Baalei Tosfos is what Dr. Soloveitchik calls dialectical revolution, both in looking at Shas globally and also in being miyashev stiros in some cases, conceptually, caused another reassessment. And the Kufa of the Ramban, you know, and the Ramah is kind of a transitional figure, but the Ramban and the Rajba and the Chachmei Provence, the Raivid in particular, the Baal HaMor and the Raivid, is the next stage from the Baalei Tosfos, working with the conclusions of Baalei Tosfos, reassessing them, you know, but from the tradition of Svarad and Provence, etc. And so Talmud Torah continues to evolve, and so I wanted to speak about bris, because that's one of the things that I was asked to speak about, and definitely is close to my heart. But I'm just trying to give you a picture about two things. Number one, that there have been different Darkei HaLimud. Different Darkei HaLimud are different emphases. They're not a zero-sum game. They're not mutually exclusive. The question, really, all the modes of thinking that we identify as brisk or conceptual or lumdis, etc., are already, there are examples of them in the Gemara, in the Rishonim, in the early Achronim. The question is a question of emphasis and also a question of, as I say, the line of development. Talmud Torah doesn't stay stationary. Part of its grandeur and its greatness is, again, this, you know, continuing the impact of everybody's insight and everybody other's insight, both, you know, as we progress through time, as well as in the Beis Medrash, the Maso Matan of people with different views, different perspectives, etc. And there were different emphases along the way, something called Pilpul, which I'm not going to discuss right now, you know, kind of radical pshat. There's a lot of discussion about, you know, what constitutes Pilpul Shel Hevel. In the response to Baalei Tosfos, you know, was not a uniform embrace. Again, we appreciate the Baalei Tosfos. Without them, we can't even imagine, you know, Limud HaTorah. We're so much a product of the implicit and explicit contributions that they made. But you should know that the, you know, the Baalei Tosfos, you know, chidushim in approach, I'm not talking about the specific chidushim they came up with, stirred tremendous controversy in its time. There were those who thought that, you know, this was the end of Talmud Torah, and that, you know, too much you know, conceptual thinking was a dangerous thing, that it took, it was antithetical to what had come before it. Halakhic history determined that the Balitosis, you know, were accepted. And on the contrary, you know, they became an impetus for the next wave, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of discussion about 14th, 15th, and 16th century, what they call Pilpul, or what the critics call Pilpula Shel Hevel. There have been discussions about Derech HaLimud and the contributions of Chachmei HaMesorah that, from a detached point of view, were a little different from the beginning, right, to our own days. What has emerged in more recent times, though, certainly since the 19th century, is a greater appreciation for a Balitosis type mentality. In other words, instead of focusing merely on the Shakta Vitaria in front of you and trying to be Miyashev Stiros or questions that come up, you can read the Gemara, and you need to read the Gemara. You need to do this also. There are no skipping of steps in Limud HaTorah. You do so at great peril to the authenticity of what you're trying to accomplish and just its suasiveness as well. You need to start with understanding the text and the Rashi and all the contributions of the Chachmei HaMesorah, the core ones who are our legacy. That's Rashi and Tosfos and the Rambam and the Ravid and the Rajba and the Ra'ah, you know, and the Gedolei HaAchronim, you know, etc. But you could spend all that time very fruitfully, and I'm a very liberal, you know, person in these matters, meaning I have very strong views of what I think is preferable and what I think is meaningful for me and for most people. But I think that we have to all cultivate a tremendous reverence for all Chachmei HaMesorah and an appreciation for the different drachim that have brought us to this point, and that are continued to be practiced by others, as long as we're talking about things that are very established. And yet, we have the right to cultivate a passion for what we think is maximal for us or in general. And kind of that's where I find myself. So for many, many centuries, while there were many conceptual breakthroughs in concepts and ideas, etc., but the greater focus, I would say, was on still the local Shaka Vitaria, with the contributions of all of these Chachmei HaMesorah in between, which already globalized the Shas and, you know, exposed many penetrating concepts that are not explicit in the Gemara, but that emerge in the totality of the analysis. And, you know, still the emphasis mostly, in other words, a person sat down to learn Gemara, it was on the text. Let's understand the Mishnah, understand the Gemara. And again, you need that. And, you know, if there's a kasha, there's a teretz, what kind of a teretz? You know, in some cases, people, hechatimtzi teretz, hamachlokas hasugyas teretz, some other kind of teretz, or a certain, you know, way of thinking, even a conceptual answer, but one which is, you know, let's say of narrower, the goal being, you know, to answer the question, to be miyashev, you know, the pirch. And that was fine, and it produced many penetrating concepts, because sometimes those answers and those insights have their own effect. What was unique in the 19th century, and it cropped up in different schools, was kind of a different kind of focus initially in the sugya, to try to develop, and it was reflected by the development of a vocabulary that would be conducive to May Rosh, you know, when you read the Sugya, you don't skip those earlier steps, I keep emphasizing. But instead of just trying to Kasha Teretz, you know, Pircha Yishuv, understand, okay, we have a good question, we have a good answer, and maybe there's an implication from the answer, etc. But May Rosh, just like the Balitosis, May Rosh scrutinized the Shas, you know, and made it one, and that kind of was a game changer, even though the ingredients, you know, for it were there previously, and even though they continued to do the old things. I'll take the world of Brisk, because it's the one that I identify with more, and it's also the one that I know best. Beginning with the Beis Halevi, and especially in the early, especially in the later years of Reb Chaim, what you had was more of a Merosh effort, when you learn the Sugya, to identify the concepts and to look conceptually at the topic. So I'm not just reading the Mishnah and the Gemara and being miyashiv questions. I'm looking the reading the Mishnah and the Gemara on Hazama, which I guess we'll speak about soon, and I'm trying to find evidence. My antennae are very conscious, meirosh, of anomalies, patterns, things that are a little bit different. How come Hazama is just being treated so differently than Akasha? You know, when the Gemara says, Hazama is a Kiddush, we'll talk about this for the group that will have it at this year. When the Gemara says, Hazama is Kiddushu, because my closest to Samka Sahai, Smoke Sahai, why isn't it simply Trey or Trey? So you could look at that question in a narrow way and just, you know, try to be Miyashev, why it is, what do you mean by that difference? Or it can be, you know, food for the grist. It can be, this is going to be a fault point, Meirosh. This is going to be an issue. This is an issue that establishes the singular nature of Hazama. Instead of minimizing it, right, the default, let's say, orientation would be to maximize it. But again, you have to be careful to know whether you're overstepping or, you know, your enthusiasm, you know, is taking you, you know, beyond what the texts say. You have to. It's a process, you know, of tzimtzum as well. That's kind of what began with the Beis Halevi and Reb Chaim in the world of Poland, you know, the world of the Avnei Nezer, at the same time Reb Chaim, Reb Meir Simcha, the Rogatchover, each with his own different vocabulary and different methodology. I'll speak again more about Reb Chaim because that's what I know best and what I identify with best. This different orientation, if you look at the earlier works of Beis Halevi and Reb Chaim, for example, you can see that it's more Kasha Teretz. There's a change at a certain point in Beis Halevi, and already you have this kind of orientation. In the family put out some of the earlier Ksavim of Reb Chaim, his diary, you know, they just put out, and some of the Shiurim that he gave in Volozhin. When you compare that to the Chiddush Reb Chaim Halevi, or what's known as the stencils, the Chiddush HaGrach HaLashas, which Talmidim wrote, but from a later period, if you're very sensitive, you could see that there's a tremendous difference. And then certainly when you move on to the Ksavim that they put out of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and especially the ample material of Rav Velvel, not only in the Sefer, but especially in the in what they call the stencils, the Ksavim of Rav Velvel, and so on and so on, what you can identify is not just the use of a vocabulary and a certain derech hachashiva way of thinking to create more of an abstract perspective, let's say, or a concept, but to Meirosh, to kind of, you know, that's the process. When I read the Sugya, when I read the Rishon, when I have the difficulty in the Rambam, I'm not looking for the Hechad Timtzi answer, and I'm actually very conscious, you know, not only what the Rambam's saying, but where he puts it. I'll get to this in just a second. You know, what extra word he puts in or omits that was in the Gemara. It's this in a dome, is what I'm trying to say. Concepts that emerge when you are analyzing something in a more parochial, narrow way, as opposed to where the enterprise itself is to assume. I mean, the implicit assumption is that when we say Kol Torah Kulo Shemosav Shalach Kodesh Baruch Hu, right? That expresses itself, you know, as a kind of system of concepts and system of abstract concepts in particular. So Brisk, for example, you know, whether this was conscious or unconscious, I don't know at the time. The Rav Zatzal in his Ish Halacha and in his Hespet for Avelvo, Madod Ech Midod, and other kind of references, and just in his regular Shaka Vitaria, you know, used to talk about this a lot. But I don't know whether Reb Chaim himself articulated it. But there are certain hallmarks that reflect, number one, that this is a Meirosh, you know, enterprise. This was a goal. That reflect that implicitly Torah is about concepts. The Rav used to say about Reb Chaim, you know, that he turned Yoredeya from pots and pans, you know, into abstractions of, you know, these beautiful concepts, you know, of Tam, Ki'ikar, and you know, and Bittul, and so on and so forth. The Rav used to say that, you know, before Reb Chaim came along, there's a little bit of a dramatic license, obviously, that before Reb Chaim came along, a shtar was a piece of paper, you know, instead of being, you know, the, you know, Reish Lakish's, you know, Eidem Achsul Mashtar Nasa Kibishin Lechkar Edusim Bebezdin, being a kind of, you know, Tfisas, you know, Edus Biyad Bal Ashtar. We'll give a couple examples if we have a few minutes, in just a minute. But how much of this was conscious or unconscious is hard to know. But at the end of the day, it's reflected by a certain perspective that the Shmos of Shel Kadosh Baruch Hu that we're talking about are values. And they are concepts. And that these concepts transcend human experience. The reason that Brisk, in my opinion, was so focused on Kachim and Taharos and Zrayim is because Kachim, Taharos, and Zrayim are an obvious, these Miktzos, HaTorah, are obviously what I call inner logic oriented. You know, we take Choshen Mishpat, so every culture has a Choshen Mishpat. We think our Choshen Mishpat, we know that our Choshen Mishpat is different. One of the reasons that it's different is because it is connected to the other Miktzos HaTorah, the Zrayim, the Kachim, and the Taharos. But what I mean by that is, when you study Taharos and you study Kachim, and some aspects of Zrayim, right, all there is an inner logic. There's no umdanas, right? There's no practicality at all. These are pure concepts, categories. And I think that is one of the reasons that Brisk was so drawn to it. Brisk was drawn to the Rambam, not only because he wrote in those areas, but for the same reason. The Rambam reclassified, reorganized Kol HaTorah Kula. First, he wrote on Kol HaTorah Kula. So it's nice and safe of an ephesy. It's a total system that appealed to the world of Brisk, appeals to everybody, but it's particularly indispensable to the world of Brisk. The Rambam reformulated and has many chidushim and took a global stance. The reason there's so many difficult Rambams is because the Rambam read the local sugya, but he read the local sugya in light of all the other related sugyas, or what he thinks are the related sugyas. Right? And therefore, he never took an easy way out. You know, he always, has a certain perspective. Reconstructing that perspective, which Briskers felt also was likely very conceptual, became a natural, there was a certain natural affinity to that. But also part of that is the classificatory chidushim of the Rambam. The Rambam reorganized all of Torah Shabbat Peh. This year, our yeshiva, we're learning Bava Kama, right? I always point out to the Talmidim in the beginning of the year that, Adam HaMazik in the Gemara, in the Mishnayos in the Gemara, is in the first six prakim of Bava Kama. It's in together with Nizkei Mamon. And the Rambam took it out of Nizkei Mamon. There's a hefsek of Geneva and Gezeila, and he put it in Hilchos Chavah. And I think that is consistent with five other things, chidushim, small and big, in my opinion, that the Rambam has about Adam HaMazik. Meaning, the Rambam was a perfect vehicle for Brisker analysis, because it was global, it put Kol HaTorah Kula in relation to each other, and the classification was telling, was suggestive. If the Rambam puts a particular halakha, in this parak of Hilchos Tefillah instead of that parak in Hilchos Tefillah, for Rav Chaim, that is not a coincidence. For anybody, it's not a coincidence. But for Rav Chaim, it's conceptually significant. If the Rambam portrays the same din in two places differently, or it seems to be aniyim b'makom echad and ashirim b'makom acher, he puts his discussion of Eidei Kiyum, in Perek Aleph of Hilchos Ishus and Perek Gimel, and then again in Perek Aleph Hilchos Geirushin and Halach Perek Tes, and there are some subtle differences. I mean, the Rambam talks about why you need Eidei Kiyum in Hilchos Geirushin. He never mentions that as an issue. He doesn't feel he has to rationalize that in Hilchos Ishus, even though he wrote Hilchos Ishus before Hilchos Geirushin. Right. To me, this is not Reb Chaim, but it's, I'm giving you an example from my own understanding. To me, that is extremely telling. The Rambam is telling you, I wrote my book, I wrote it in, and organized it in a way that you should be reading it very carefully. You should be really scrutinizing this book and its organizational whatever, because by doing so, you will understand conceptually the subtle but very critical distinctions that I'm making, or what it is that I'm conveying. The Rambam, when he talks about Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, in Hilchos Trumos, Perek Aleph, he talks about at the beginning, he gives you the impression that Kedushas Haaretz, Bizman Hazeh, for Trumos and Maisers and Shvius, is Doraisa. He starts off by saying, Kedusha Rishona was Batel, Kedusha Shniyah of Ezra was, Kitchel Lashaita, Kitchel Las of Lavo. If you close the Rambam in Hilchos Trumos after Halacha Hay, Perek Aleph Halacha Hay, you think it's all Doraisa. then you have to wait till Halacha Chavav, when he finally gets to his expanded Chiddush understanding of what we call Bias Kolchem, to find out that he thinks that Trumos and probably Maestros and Chala, and then, you know, if you look into the Shvias, maybe even Shemitah, they're all actually Drabanan based on Bias Kolchem. Right? Why did he do that? I mean, obviously he wasn't just writing a practical code. The Shulchan Aruch is much more of a practical code than the Rambam is. The Rambam was a classicist, you know, he was, you know, from the greats of all time. He doesn't need my askama, but he wrote a work that was both a halacha lemaisa work for his generation, and even more important, a conceptual presentation of Kol HaTorah Kula l'dori doros. And he made decisions about where to put things, you know, which included being inefficient as a practical code, in my opinion, for the sake of being more conceptually accurate, because the ultimate legacy of what he produced for us was not a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, right, but a perspective on Kol HaTorah Kula. And Reb Chaim and Brisk picked up on that. But it's, of course, not limited to the Rambam. I'm trying to explain the vocabulary of Brisk. Also, Gavra, Cheftza, Chalos. You have to be careful in the use of terminology. Brisk avoided using what we'll call more common or extraneous terminology. For example, in contrast to the Rogatchover. Rogatchover, who, you know, was a contemporary of Reb Chaim and also was an extremely conceptual thinker, in the sense that, again, he too was looking for, you know, unifying, you know, theories, you know, and you know, was very, very abstract in his analysis, but a different kind of analysis. Rogatchover tries to integrate the Rambam in Yana Chazaka and the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim. He uses philosophical terminology. Reb Chaim avoided it completely. From reading Reb Chaim's, you know, halachic writings, which is what we have, you would not know, I don't think, whether he ever opened up a Mor Nevuchim. In the family, at least, they say that he knew it by, you know, Baal Peh. I don't, you can't know that from the Kiddush Reb Chaim Alevi, or the Shiurim in Volozhin, or the Ksavim, or the stencils, etc. Brisk avoided the use of any kind of external terminology because they felt that it kind of corrupted the inner logic aspect of Torah, what I mentioned before. The reason that Kachim, Taurus, and Zeroyim are so fetching, so compelling for Brisk is because the concepts don't have to fit into the real world. The real world has to fit into the concepts. Like when Chazal say that, you know, Stako Baraisa Bar Alma, so the Rav in Ish Halacha and Madod Echmedod explains, what that really means is that the real perfection in the world, right, Bishvil HaTorah Shedekoreshis, is the concepts of Torah. Our goal in life is to approximate as much as possible to live in the Dalet Amos Shel Halacha, to be Ishe Halacha, to implement those values and those concepts that are in their purest in the Torah itself. So Kodshim's inner logic and Zeroyim and Taros, and the use of terminology, even when we're talking about Dinim, right, becomes an expression of that Hashkafa and of that Halachic perspective. Dinim, I know it's fascinating, you know, the parsha that we read last week, you have the Hosafos of Mara. And Rashi says they're Paraduma, Dinin, and Shabbos. So again, there are different, much has been said about it. But I always thought, you know, first of all, two things. Number one, the Ramban already asks, they added these mitzvos and Mara, how come they're not formulated in a way that is consistent with Tzivuyim, Alapai, Baitzah, Vayomer? This should be identifying the mitzvos because now they're chayiv to implement them. So the Ramban says, no. The whole thing of Mara wasn't that they were obligated kiyum mitzvos at that point. It was esek kataros limara Torah. The antidote, we'll go into the whole thing, for the complaints of the post kriyas yamsuf was you have to immerse yourself in Dvar Hashem, and you have to do it in a way, you know, that redefines what it means to be an Oved Hashem. So what do they include in there? Shabbos, that's a natural, that's kedusha, and that's the spiritual focus of the secular world. But paraduma and dinim, those are the range. Paraduma is the inner logic of halacha, chok, but not just a chok as a test. An inner logic. If you can understand the dinim of paraduma from within, That's what we're supposed to do. But dinim, which is the most pragmatic area of halacha, choshem mishpat, bavakama, bavmetzia, sanhedrin, makos. The truth is, because Torah chasuma and Megillah, right, because it's all connected with the taurus and the kodshim, there's a certain inner logic in dinim too. Or put it this way, dinim are not just efficient, dinim are an expression of kedusha, because they too represent the value, these ideal values that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Dvar Hashem that we're supposed to attach ourselves to. For that reason, shtar, which in sugyas, in ksuvas, could be read as an amalgam of umdanas, right? You know, what's he likely to, you know, he gave the piece of paper, but has a dechasima, he wouldn't have done it unless he actually, you know, handed it over, what's the likelihood of it falling and this guy picking it up. You could learn dine shtaros in a very pragmatic way. And surely the umdanas are part of the story. People have to understand that too. But Reb Chaim understood, that's what the Rav meant when he said that a shtar used to be a piece of paper. Reb Chaim understood that the din of shtaros is a concept. It's edus biksav. But it's edus biksav based on the legal chalos status of there being a balashtar who is able to read plausible Haggadah Seidos into the shtar. And explains many things. It's an amalgam of the umdanos, which are about the plausibility, but it doesn't end there. It's not umdain ochem b'momen acharov. You can't, it doesn't work. It's really about, you know, this special status of chetza shel edus, even though there's no god, the edim, of, you know, they signed their, you know, signature and they went off. They never saw the kedushin or the gerushin or, it doesn't matter. It's chetza shel edus. I mean, this is all about inner logic and the use of vocabulary and the use of parallels to identify what that is. And the truth is that there is a tremendous hashkafic analog to this, and that what the Rav really developed in Ish Halacha, and again in Mado Dech Midod, and that is that a person, an Oved Hashem, he doesn't just live in this world and try to stay out of trouble. You know, he's supposed to do that also. And then, you know, involve himself in Limud HaTorah, which is Dvar Hashem. And of course, but the real idea is that the immersion in Dvar Hashem, the connection with these concepts, is transforming. And as the Rav describes in Ish Halacha, they become the prism, they become the way that we look at the rest of the world. You look at the world through the lenses of Halacha, because the ultimate reality, the perfection of reality, the Platonic reality in the world of halacha, in the world, is, you know, stako bo raiso bara alma. If that are not just details, but concepts and values, and not just concepts and values, but concepts and values that come from the Ribbono Shel Olam, and therefore they have their own inner logic. Sometimes, I mean, we only can use human logic, you know, to decipher them. But what we need to be trained is, and this is what Brisk does, to reconstruct. You know, it's, you know, batel ritzon chal ritzono. You learn the sugya. You know, Abai and Rava and Rashi and the Rambam are leading you. And what you're trying to do is understand them and reconstruct. This, you know, Brisk is very descriptive and much, you know, in some cases, less explanatory. That's all because what we're dealing with are abstract divine concepts, which we are connecting ourselves to, and being redefined by. What the Rav describes in Ish Halacha in the first half is being a mitzuveh, being somebody who surrenders not just to the dictates, the demands of the system, but even more so, who surrenders his mind and his way of thinking to the system. But the second half of Ish Halacha, which is equally important, is once you've done that, then you become like an insider. You become attuned to the system, and as an insider, you have insights and chidushim to share with others. You might find a wrinkle, right, that hitherto, you know, has never been explicated or articulated, you know, but that really explains even better, more precisely, Dvar Hashem, Kishem Hashem Ekra, Avogod Elokei. I don't know if I have time for an example or two, do I? Or it's late. What?
Might be a little late. Short example?
Okay. So, I'll just give, you know, one example. You know, the Gemara says in a couple of places that you know, in hokam b'mamon acharon. I'll give some one example. I'm going to take 50 examples, but in hokam b'mamon acharon. And therefore, the Gemara tells a story in, you know, Bava Kama and Bava Basra. You know, if you have the Gemara in Bava Kama, you have the case of Mekach Tos. A person buys an animal, right? And it, you know, depending on whether you bought it, you know, for as a work animal or as, you know, a steak dinner, that's going to dictate, you know, whether the animal that he was sold is a Mekach Tos or not. So the Gemara says about that and other cases that ain't hochem b'mamon acharon. And as you know, when it comes to Sanhedrin, the Gemara says in the beginning of Sanhedrin that a Sanhedrin in Dine Mamonis goes by Rov, right? By the majority of, you have three Dayanim and two out of three. So the Bali Tosis in Bava Kama and Sanhedrin asks this question: what happened to Ein Hochem B'Mamon Achar Rov? And the Bali Tosis in Bava Kama, at least, they give different answers. You know, some Tosis say this is Gemara's exception, that Gemara's the exception. They try to make distinctions between, you know, different quantities or qualities of rov. This is a great, I'm just trying to use a succinct example, different darke halimud, it's a machlokas hasugyas. We're not talking about the same actual rov, either because one is more quantitatively persuasive, one's an 80%, one's a 60%, or no, there's different types of rov, a rubidisa kaman, rubidlesa kaman, all distinctions. The Bali Tosis kind of distinctions. And then finally, Bali Tosis have another suggestion, and that is that when it comes to Sanhedrin, the Rov negates the Miyud. The Miyud is Kemishen. And when it comes to these other cases, like Mekach Tosis, the Miyud is not Kemishen. But it's a very succinct and very amorphous, ambiguous line. So what does Tosis mean? So if you, I just think this is a little vignette, and again, you could, there are hundreds of them. So some of the acronyms, you know, make different suggestions. You know, some of them say, oh, what Bali Tosis here mean is that Sanhedrin, a Bezdin, you know, has certain, you know, powers, in addition to everything, in addition to determining the halacha, there's also a din of Hefker Bezdin Hefker, and din imamanis. So what we mean is there's no miut here. The miut is kamandalesa because, you know, when they decide that this is likely what happened, maybe they kind of implicitly also invest their status as hefker bezen hefker. So their psak is a vadai. Then does their rove dictated that, you know, if they're wrong in the miut, the motzei mechaber levaraya, but they're being mafkir this person's mamo. That's how some achronim interpret. Other achronim, tumim and others, give, and that's a fascinating answer. It's a very ingenious answer. It's not obvious that the hefker bezen hefker component is implicit in a din Torah and a hachra. I don't want to analyze each one, but okay. The tumim, for example, has another very interesting logical distinction. Tumim says there's a difference between a miut and a rov, which are mutually exclusive, and ones which are acknowledged to exist side by side. Like if you have most people buying an animal for farm use, and, you know, a miut using it for a steak dinner, right? Both of those populations exist. There's no stira between the rove and the miut. But if you're talking about a din Torah, and one person is right and the other person is wrong, so, you know, whoever's right is completely right and the other's wrong is completely wrong. We're just not sure. There, it's a rove and a miut that are makhish each other, and we treat that differently than we treat the other. Again, a very ingenious answer. And therefore, for example, the same would apply for a machlokas between chachmei Yisrael, between poskim. That's the Tumim's perspective, and it's very, very a very logical answer, and it's it brings up a new issue in halacha. The truth is, Reb Chaim's response was very famously that there are two dinim in rov, although they're connected to each other, but they're two dinim. Right, one din is the din of azina basar rov, and that's what applies if you're trying to figure out whether he bought the animal for this purpose or that purpose. You know, you go by the majority cases. However, when it comes to a Sanhedrin, for various other reasons, right, the din is decided by the Birur HaDin, is decided by Azlina Basarov. But the vote in the Sanhedrin is not based on Azlina Basarov. It's based on the perspective on what a Sanhedrin is. And it's really based on the principle of what we call Rubo Kekulo, which exists in other areas of halacha, where we're not talking about the rove outweighing the miut, we're talking about the rove when it is representative of the whole. Like you don't have to do shchita kolas siman, If you're shochet rov ha-simon, then you're shochet the simon. So in the Bezdin, Paskins, two out of three, instead of saying it's two dayanim against one, what we're saying is the three panel dayanim came to a conclusion based on the majority of the three. Is that like, sounds like splitting hairs? Not splitting hairs at all. Now the truth is, it's a great example, because if you look back at the Lashon of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and Daf Lamed, they talk about malpractice for a dayan. The dayanim made a mistake, but the only one who was right was the one who voted against. You know, what happens? You know, how do you split the malpractice, you know, liability? I'm not going to go into details. But the point, the shonus of the Gemara, practically, you could have missed it without Reb Chaim, or maybe not. But certainly, in light of Reb Chaim, you read the whole Gemara in a different way. And the poskim, the ksos, the masivas are numerous. Yerushalmi, does the other guy have to be present at the time of the psak? Is he part of the psak, or is he against the psak? Right? Is he, you know, libel, and so on and so forth. Numerous nafkamina. Again, it's fascinating. If you look at the Kuntres HaSfeikos, he says something very similar to Reb Chaim, but different. And I think this is the point. And you can demonstrate this with Reb Chaim and the Nesivas and Shtaros, many and many other cases. What he says is, well, there are three Dayanim, but implicitly when Dayanim sit together, the third one kind of implicitly signs on that he's going to accept the position and endorse the position of the other two. And not to do so constitutes almost like a quasi-Zakein Mamre, you know, circumstance. So he's obligated to support his fellow Dayanim. Very similar. In other words, the three, you know, it's not really two, it's three. And that's what Tosis means when it says command delays. But conceptually, those are two totally different ideas. I mean, Reb Chaim was underscoring that, in other words, the stira, or Meirosh, he was on scrutinizing to try to establish that, you know, what is a bez then? And when we say rov, what do we mean? Right? And is Ozlina Basa rov the same as Ruba Kekulo? Right? And the models of other places, which you have to be careful about, that's another thing to talk about that we don't have time. You know, do you assume a global, you know, kind of unified principle, or do you assume things are narrower? Even within the world of brisk, that's an open question. But what I'm trying to highlight is that the idea of conceptual thinking, you know, of taking the evidence, the contradictions, the anomalies, why do you need to psukim? Why is it formulated in this peculiar way? Why does the Torah Shebichsav emphasize this and not that if the Torah Shemapes says it's all? Why is it ayin takasayin, you know, mamish in the pshat if it's ayin takasayin mamon, you know, in the halacha? The conceptual approach basically looks to a more unified perspective and a more concept oriented, you know, perspective as well. Let me just finish with one thought. The Rav used to say about his grandfather, about Reb Chaim, you know, the Rav was, I would say the biggest fan, but there was no bigger fan, certainly. So he used to say, as I said before, Reb Chaim's, you know, Chidushim, Reb Chaim transformed, you know, the Imel HaTorah. If not for Reb Chaim, you know, the, you know, Yoredeya would be pots and pans. He was very eloquent about Reb Chaim. He also used to say, whenever he would encounter a Rishon that he particularly liked, you know, the Rimigash on Mashkon and the Ravid on, you know, Batla Metzasa Batla Kula and the Rabbeinu Tam on Shibudit, whatever it was, he'd say, oh, the precursor of Reb Chaim. And then sometimes, or the Nesivas, and then sometimes he would say that anybody who thinks that Reb Chaim's revolution, as he called it, but what he meant was that it's an evolution, was a, you know, was disconnected from, you know, the Rambam and the Ravid and the Ra'ah and the Rajba, and the Ksos and the Nesivas and the Shach and the Taz understands nothing about learning. So that sounds like a stira, right? But of course, that's not a stira. That's what Talmud Torah has been from the very beginning. It's an appreciation of Moshe Kibbutz Torah in Sinai and the Gilui Shkina, which, you know, diffused, but of course was one more than it was, you know, Shivim, but it was still Shivim. But at the same time, you know, the ability to, That's our task, you know, to contribute to the Masorah in a way that builds on the reverence that we have of all the previous stages, but then, you know, unselfconsciously, not only legitimately, but as an absolute kiyum in Talmud Torah, right, to bring our own insights, assuming that we've put in the hard work and immersed ourselves and we're not just speaking off the top of our head, right, to understand the concepts, to internalize them, to become ishei halacha in that way. That's how Talmud Torah continues to be dynamic and exciting. Kihem chayenu v'orach yameinu, the source for v'chaye olam nota besochem. Thank you.